It's pay to play. It's quid pro quo. And unless we stop the system of money in politics, we're done, because then our lives will simply be ruled by the people who have the most money.
And Alex, how do these films relate to your earlier work, in particular the crime of the century on the opioid crisis?
Well, it was doing a film on the opioid crisis that made me understand that one of the reasons there was such an anemic response to literally the intentional poisoning of America by a few corporations was because so many people in Congress were being paid off to look the other way, to focus on the needs of their donors rather than on the needs of their constituents. So it was that anger that led me to investigate this. We found an extraordinary story in Ohio that's literally quid pro quo corruption. And all the people on the FBI wiretaps are saying it's good now because of Citizens United. And then we tried to look back at how we got to this place by looking at the corruption of the Supreme Court. So, you know, and I was inspired, as you say, by the great work of Jane Mayer, who's in the film.
And in terms of the what you're hoping people will do, especially this coming out on the 15th anniversary of the Citizens United case?
Yes. I mean, I hadn't originally intended for that to be the case, but nothing could be more apt, because Citizens United is the single most damaging decision the Supreme Court has come up with in the last 15 years, because it's destroyed our democracy. And we need to understand that in order to get our democracy back, we have to reinvigorate our laws, as many states are doing, in order to be able to end this system of essentially legalized corruption.
Alex, we want to stay with you. We want to stay with you and post online our second part at democracynow.org. Alex Gibney, Academy Award-winning director of the new HBO original series, The Dark Money Game, premiering tonight. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO on April 22nd at 10 a.m. for Rockin' Out with DJ Fluorite, a part of KBOO's special Earth Day programming. This program is dedicated to geology in honor of Earth Day, so tune in to learn about rocks while listening to rock. You won't want to miss it. That's Rockin' Out with DJ Fluorite on April 22nd at 10 a.m., only on KBOO.
Willamette Week is seeking nominations for their annual Best of Portland Readers Poll. Show your support for KBOO by nominating us for Best Radio Station before noon on Friday, April 25th. Go to kboo.fm and click the Best of Portland banner to submit a nomination. Thank you for supporting your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Deschutes County District Attorney puts the sheriff on a credibility watch list. Oregon leaders push back on federal efforts to undermine school funding. And a unique program in Washington helps to prevent youth homelessness. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 15, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. The Deschutes County District Attorney, Steve Gunnels, placed the county's top cop, Kent Vanderkamp, on the county's Brady List. The Brady List is a list of law enforcement officers who have known credibility concerns that impact their testimony in court. District Attorney Gunnels says, quote, "We have concerns about his character for truthfulness and are unable to call him as a witness from this point forward," end quote. Before his election to sheriff, Vanderkamp gave false testimony in more than one criminal case, and now many of his past cases are under review, according to District Attorney Gunnels. In a statement from the sheriff's office, Vanderkamp says, quote, "I am deeply disappointed by the recent decision by District Attorney Steve Gunnels to place me on the Brady List. While I respectfully dispute the reasoning behind this action, I understand the seriousness of the situation and the impact it may have on the sheriff's office and the public trust," end quote. The DA has said he is convinced Vanderkamp gave false testimony in many local criminal cases, but declined to say just how many cases are under investigation. The DA also declined to provide a copy of his office's investigation, which ended last week. In addition to questions regarding his work in Deschutes County, Sheriff Vanderkamp faced scrutiny related to his previous law enforcement experience in La Mesa, California. 11 states are rejecting a demand from the U.S. Department of Education to comply with a sudden rule change to end, quote, "illegal DEI." Oregon and Washington are pushing back. KBOO reporter Kenny has more.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek and Oregon Department of Education Director Charlene Williams are refusing to sign off on a demand from the U.S. Department of Education. This demand, sent on April 3rd, is requiring schools to remove DEI initiatives or face loss of federal funding. States are required to respond by April 24th. The Trump administration cited that the Supreme Court case Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, which held that Harvard's use of race-conscious admissions in affirmative action violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Both Oregon and Washington officials argued that the states have already submitted the certifications required by federal law. Oregon Education Director Williams says the demand is, quote, "duplicative, unnecessary, and unduly bothersome," end quote. Oregon officials argued that there must be a justification for the sudden shift in policy, since it's not a part of the regular process. Many felt the demand was unclear because illegal DEI was not fully defined. In March, President Trump tried to close the Education Department entirely, as well as fire federal staff. Oregon receives 10 to 14% of its public education budget from the federal government each year. If lost, this could force the schools to find funding elsewhere. The response from state leaders comes as local school officials in Oregon have reached out to reassure parents, students, and staff. In a message to the North Clackamas School District community on April 4th, Superintendent Shay James restated support for the values of the school. James said the district will, quote, "build relationships with students that honor their cultural heritage, foster their well-being, and engage each student to reach their full potential," end quote. James encouraged teachers to, quote, "continue focusing on what we can control, building trusting relationships with students and families, providing excellent instruction, and modeling calm and care." There are 11 total states pushing back against the Trump administration on demand ending so-called illegal DEI in public schools. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Kenny.
A new program aimed at preventing youth homelessness in Washington has an over 93% success rate. The program, which serves 9 counties, provides flexible funding to get young people into safe homes quickly. Isabel Charlet reports.
A unique approach to preventing youth homelessness in Washington is proving highly effective, with more than 93% of participants still housed 1 year later. The Homelessness Prevention and Diversion Fund provides flexible aid to young people in 9 Washington counties. In its first 3 years, it has helped more than 1,700 young people find safe housing. Washington has the nation's third highest homelessness rate, and supporters say the program saves money by removing red tape and keeping youth out of shelters. The strategy, says North Star Advocates Jim Theophilus, is simple. Ask youth what they need.
We actually asked the young person, where can you live and what will that take to make that happen? which is a very different approach than saying, go to that shelter 3 miles down and take a right.
Instead of using a central nonprofit, Theophilus says the program trains advocates in places where homeless youth go for help, like drop-in centers and fire stations, so they can quickly access funds to get into safe housing. Lawmakers are considering cuts to the program, which Theophilus warns would raise state costs and reduce support for young people. Most young people have somewhere safe they can go, Theophilus adds, but they may need a small financial boost to make the transition.
Some people will say, I could live with grandma, but she's really poor and she needs some help. Or I'm 23, I have two friends and I could get a room with them if I had first and last month's rent.
Theophilus says youth typically face more steps to find housing, starting with shelters and case management, while HPDF is much faster. After an application, advocates ensure the housing is safe and send a one-time payment averaging $2,700 directly where it's needed. Theophilus says this is much cheaper than other strategies.
We're saving emergency shelter beds, all kinds of other funding sources that come into play once they hit the street. We really think this saves money and helps reduce our budget deficit, as well as saving lives.
Of the teens and young adults the program has served, about 60% are people of color and nearly 40% are pregnant or parenting. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The on-again, off-again slate of tariffs on foreign imports to the United States have many unsure of their financial future. One economist warns that a state like Texas would lose billions of dollars if the tariffs against Mexico and Canada go into effect. Frida Ross has more from Austin.
Texas is the number one exporting state in the nation. And although tariffs with Mexico and Canada have been delayed, Texans are still uneasy about their financial future. President Donald Trump has levied a 145% tariff on products from China, with all other countries subject to a 10% tariff. Economist Ray Perryman says as the trade wars continue, Texans can expect to pay higher prices for everything.
When steel and aluminum cost more and lumber cost more, that means houses cost more. There's a lot of cars that are made in Texas where various pieces of it cross the border 5 or 6 times. So when you start levying a 25% tariff every time something crosses the border, that's when you start adding thousands of dollars to the price of a car.
Mexico is the top import-export market for the Lone Star State, and Texas companies imported almost $160 billion in goods last year. A report by the Perryman Group estimates if the tariffs with China remain in place and tariffs with Mexico and Canada are unfrozen, Texas will lose more than $50 billion a year and more than 400,000 jobs. Perryman adds the uncertainty of the markets is crippling.
One of the worst things for an economy is uncertainty, because if you're not sure what's going to happen, you don't know what to do. And most people respond to that by not doing anything. You don't want to bring out a new product. You don't want to build a new plant. You don't want to hire more people. You don't want to make a big purchase if you're uncertain about the future.
Perryman predicts if tariffs with Mexico and Canada go into effect, all the tariffs combined would cost each American household an additional $1,500 a year. I'm Frida Ross, Texas News Service.
Overfishing is a growing problem in California and across the nation's coasts. As Suzanne Potter reports, fishery experts are working to improve data collection and enforcement around the world.
Research shows that 34% of the world's oceans were overfished as of 2017, up from 10% in 1974. So, experts on fisheries are speaking out. The Marine Stewardship Council says a species is considered overfished when too many fish in a particular stock are caught, and there are not enough adults to breed and sustain a healthy population. Professor Ray Hilborn with the University of Washington says the idea is to fish just the right amount for the best yield without harming the population.
If you don't fish at all, you obviously don't get any long-term catch. If you fish too hard, you get very little long-term catch. And sort of in the middle is this theoretical sweet spot that produces what's called maximum sustainable yield.
Extreme overfishing can interrupt the marine food chain, harm ecosystems, wipe out local fish populations, and hurt the communities that depend on them. However, many countries lack the expertise to collect the data that scientists need to assess the health of their fishing stock, and fail to put monitors on fishing boats or enforce rules for good fish management. Beth Polidoro with the Marine Stewardship Council says the U.S. is a leader in fishery management, while the Food and Agriculture Organization, based in Rome, fosters collaboration between countries to manage fish stocks that migrate across transnational marine boundaries.
We do know what works to reduce overfishing. Having good data collection, good monitoring, good species population models, good management, good cooperation and enforcement of fishing quotas.
Some experts have called on countries to reduce bycatch, establish more marine protected areas, and stop subsidizing fuel for shipping vessels. This story was produced with original reporting by Seth Milstein for Sentient. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather, there will be evening highs around 59 degrees and overnight lows of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy skies with a high of 68 degrees and overnight lows of 43 degrees. Today in history, Jackie Robinson, who broke baseball's racial barrier, played in his first major league game for the Brooklyn Dodgers at Ebbets Field. The quote of the day is from Leonardo da Vinci, who said, quote, "As a well-spent day brings happy sleep, so a life well-spent brings happy death." A new program in Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana focuses on getting and keeping housing for people who've been released from prison. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new federal effort aims to end homelessness among people released from prisons. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports, communities in Wyoming and Idaho and a tribe in Montana are part of the initiative.
One team is in Wyoming's Natrona County. It's the top destination for parolees in the state since there's a lot of reentry services there. But it's still hard to get long-term housing.
We definitely see an influx of individuals who come here for assistance and who don't qualify for as much as they think.
But Natrona's Christy Oster, who's leading the project under the U.S. Bureau of Justice Assistance, says people released from prisons could soon get permanent housing and other help like career services. So far, there's no funding involved, but Oster says monthly meetings with federal experts keep them on track to eventually build the housing.
Is it data that's next? Is it partnerships that is next? Is it getting the city together to determine if there's land available?
Idaho's Department of Corrections and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in Montana are also working on similar initiatives. I'm Hannah Merzbach.
Police are investigating a fire that burned the Student Union building on Diné College in Salie, Arizona, destroying records dating back to the 1950s and gowns for this year's graduation. Navajo police say the fire was reported around 2:30 a.m. Monday. The campus closed to the public while essential services like food and housing were relocated for students. Remote learning was being planned for Tuesday. No injuries were reported. The fire is under investigation. Willie Hensley is a well-known Alaska Native leader, but a documentary that premiered this week in Anchorage gives you a chance to get to know what makes him tick. KMBA's Rhonda McBride has this preview.
Willie Hensley has worn a lot of hats in his life, and you can see a lot of them in Marla Williams' film, as well as something else.
That was really fun in this film, to look at how many different hairstyles Willie has had throughout his life. He's gone from a flat top and a nerdy little side part to long 60s sideburns, and now to a ponytail all the way down his back.
The film gives you a taste of Hensley's personal charm and traditional Inupiaq humor as it follows his rise as a champion for the Native land rights movement and transformation into a statewide leader.
I think he's a man of his times. He's always current. He's always looking forward, but he's not stuck in his past. He uses his past to keep him moving forward.
The film also takes you to a religious boarding school in Tennessee, where Hensley arrived as a teenager with only a shopping bag full of belongings. His classmates didn't quite know what to make of the care packages of whale meat and other subsistence foods he received, but were happy to have him on their football team because he was one of the fastest on the field.
In those days, if you were a young Inupiaq that age, if you survived TB and chickenpox and influenza and everything else that everybody caught, you were pretty damn tough.
The documentary's next showing will be in Hensley's hometown of Kotzebue on April 17th and can later be seen online. It is the 10th installment of the Magnetic North, the Alaska Character Series, which has profiled political figures like Governor Bill Sheffield and Native leaders like Jacob Adams and carver Nathan Jackson. The series was made possible by the Alaska Humanities Forum and the Rasmussen Foundation. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Advocates fighting hunger in the state are calling on supporters to rally behind the Food for All Oregonians bill, which would extend food benefits to Oregon's young children, regardless of their immigration status. KBOO's Lexis Ponce has more.
Advocates fighting hunger in the state are calling on supporters to rally behind the Food for All Oregonians bill, which would extend food benefits to Oregon's young children, regardless of their immigration status. Comments by Ali King, Policy and Advocacy Director, Our Children, Oregon. Each legislative session, Oregon's Joint Ways and Means Committee holds a statewide roadshow to hear from residents about their priorities. At the Salem stop this Wednesday, April 16th, supporters of the Food for All Oregonians bill are urging people to speak up. A coalition of over 180 organizations say bipartisan momentum is growing behind the bill, which would extend food benefits to all of the state's kids, regardless of their immigration status. Ali King from Our Children, Oregon, a member of the coalition, says policy experts, parents, and other supporters of the bill have a clear message.
We've all seen firsthand how our worsening hunger crisis impacts our children and state, and it's unacceptable that one in six Oregon children don't have enough to eat.
King says Food for All Oregonians is one of the top priorities for her organization's Children's Agenda, a package of legislation dedicated to improving the well-being of Oregon's children, youth, and families. The bill is currently in the Ways and Means Committee. A previous version of Food for All Oregonians would have extended food benefits to older adults as well as children. Opponents take issue with providing food benefits to people who are undocumented. King says, though the bill is linked to immigration status, it is not only about immigration.
We can't allow Oregon's innocent children to become the collateral damage of partisan politics. It's really important that regardless of your views on immigration, we recognize that no one deserves to go hungry.
Food for All Oregonians would establish a new program in the Department of Human Services to provide food benefits to children up to 6 years old who would otherwise qualify for SNAP, but for their immigration status. The estimated cost for this binium is about $7.5 million. Coalition members say they will continue to work until all Oregonians have access to the food benefits they need. For KBOO News and Oregon News Service, this is Lexis Ponce.
Overfishing is a growing problem in California and across the nation's coasts. As Suzanne Potter reports, fishery experts are working to improve data collection and enforcement around the world.
Research shows that 34% of the world's oceans were overfished as of 2017, up from 10% in 1974. So, experts on fisheries are speaking out. The Marine Stewardship Council says a species is considered overfished when too many fish in a particular stock are caught, and there are not enough adults to breed and sustain a healthy population. Professor Ray Hilborn with the University of Washington says the idea is to fish just the right amount for the best yield without harming the population.
If you don't fish at all, you obviously don't get any long-term catch. If you fish too hard, you get very little long-term catch. And sort of in the middle is this theoretical sweet spot that produces what's called maximum sustainable yield.
Extreme overfishing can interrupt the marine food chain, harm ecosystems, wipe out local fish populations, and hurt the communities that depend on them. However, many countries lack the expertise to collect the data that scientists need to assess the health of their fishing stock, and fail to put monitors on fishing boats or enforce rules for good fish management. Beth Polidoro with the Marine Stewardship Council says the U.S. is a leader in fishery management, while the Food and Agriculture Organization, based in Rome, fosters collaboration between countries to manage fish stocks that migrate across transnational marine boundaries.
We do know what works to reduce overfishing. Having good data collection, good monitoring, good species population models, good management, good cooperation and enforcement of fishing quotas.
Some experts have called on countries to reduce bycatch, establish more marine protected areas, and stop subsidizing fuel for shipping vessels. This story was produced with original reporting by Seth Milstein for Sentient. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
We now go to Global Citizen commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says Donald Trump and his aides are pretending that his tariffs are succeeding and that China has panicked. But in his view, nothing could be farther from the truth. Instead, he asserts, the tariffs are causing untold damage to many countries that rely on the U.S., and China is already taking advantage of Trump's delusions. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. It takes a certain kind of person who celebrates when something occurs that she had predicted would not. Likewise, it takes a certain kind of person who pretends that a dramatic failure actually was a triumph. Both these types have emerged with Donald Trump's 90-day pause in his tariff war, after the stock market had lost several trillion dollars in value. They belong to the same fantasy world in which election defeats are fraudulent, legitimate lawsuits are witch hunts, judges who rule against them are crazy Marxists, and foreign students who protest are terrorists and must be deported. In Trump world, the decision to pause the worldwide tariffs was not for the obvious reason that it was a looming catastrophe, one that was propelling the U.S. economy toward a recession, forcing U.S. allies and friends in other major economies to plan retaliation, and causing anguish among billionaires and even some in Trump's inner circle. No, the decision, he insisted, was in deference to the needless anxieties of some people around him. So he generously decided to give everyone except the Chinese a breather. Far be it from the Donald to admit that he doesn't understand tariffs and that he's worried about polls that show how exceptionally unpopular are his tariffs and, for that matter, his entire economic policy. Most especially, Trump and his aides don't understand the Chinese. For reasons that go back to China's 19th century history with the West, Chinese leaders don't react well to perceived bullying. They showed this the first time around with Trump's tariff war and now again. They will retaliate, not buckle, to U.S. pressure. China will deepen economic involvement in the global South, the developing countries. In fact, Xi Jinping just yesterday visited Vietnam and Cambodia. They will also expand self-reliance in goods it typically imports, give greater attention to increasing household consumption, and draw an even tighter link between economic and national security. Trump said on Truth Social, April 4th, quote, China played it wrong. They panicked, the one thing they cannot afford to do. To the contrary, China will not only match Trump's tariffs, it will deny the U.S. critical imports, such as rare earth minerals. And one other thing the Chinese won't do. Xi Jinping won't call Trump or agree to a summit meeting begging for relief. It takes a good deal of self-delusion to make Trump's tariff war look like a win. But Trump is surrounded by delusional people. One is Stephen Miller, the deputy chief of staff, who said, quote, President Trump's master strategy, bold statesmanship, and brilliant tactical planning has done more to reform broken international trade in days than anyone has achieved in decades, while economically and politically isolating the global architect of economic aggression, China. That's the kind of laudatory language we can read any day in the Chinese People's Daily, extolling Xi Jinping. Another of Trump's supreme loyalists is Peter Navarro, the architect of the tariff war, who served time in jail for his loyalty to Trump. Elon Musk calls Navarro a moron and his Harvard education a bad thing for advocating what amounts to a tax on American consumers. But Navarro, drawing upon his long-standing hostility toward China, has been unrelenting. It was Navarro who authored the trade section of the Project 2025 handbook, in which he advocated a complete economic decoupling of the U.S. from China. Looks like he's succeeding, which makes him believe not just that he's done the right thing, but that the tariff war has gone precisely as planned. How about House Speaker Mike Johnson? Behold the art of the deal, Johnson said. President Trump has created leverage, brought many countries to the table, and will deliver for American workers, American manufacturers, and America's future. Never mind looming inflation or the decision of many multinational corporations based in China, like Apple, to stay there rather than return home or go to a third country. As usual, the great majority of Republicans in Congress refuse to criticize Trump. Many wince at the tariffs, and some, like Ted Cruz, actually call it, for what it is, a tax on consumers, but then go on to wish Trump well. Only about a half dozen Republicans back proposed legislation in the Senate, the Grassley-Cantwell bill, that would require the president to give Congress 48 hours notice of any new tariffs and require House and Senate approval within 60 days, or they would automatically be canceled. The bill doesn't have a ghost of a chance of making it to Trump's desk, where he would veto it anyway. Finally, there is Trump himself trying to show supreme confidence. On April 10th, he claims his administration was, quote, doing really well on our tariff policy. But neither he nor any of his cabinet members have been able to cite a single instance other than Vietnam of talks underway with foreign leaders or trade deals nearing completion. Fact is, there aren't any. No matter, Trump says they'll all come running to kiss his behind. No one around him dares say otherwise. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 15, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's news